Hi, so this is going to be an informal talk, but I'm going to present data. The question that we are trying to answer here is about antiretroviral therapy for HIV-infected patients. So it is well known now that CART, CART, which is combined antiretroviral therapy, is very effective to prevent AIDS and death in HIV-infected subjects. But what is not known is when is the best time to start that therapy. If you start too early, you may have more side effects and resistance, etc. If you start too late, it may be too late to really help because the person is already very immunocompromised. Currently, the most commonly followed recommendation is to start the first time that CD4 count, which is a measure of how immunosuppressed the patient is, drops below 350. And there is a lot of discussion about whether it should be 350 or 500 or some number in between or some number greater than 500. There are lots of studies and lots of people trying to answer this question. It's one of the hottest topics in HIV epidemiology now. There was a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine 2 weeks ago about this very topic, and there is a lot of financial interest too in this issue. There is a lot of money that is spent in antiretroviral therapy in the Western world. If this is 500, then that means that you have to treat many more people earlier than if it is 350, and if you translate that into Africa or countries, is huge. So this is a very important topic. And I'm going to give you the answer to this. So this setting is a follow-up study of HIV-infected patients. So this is part of the HIV COSAR collaboration, which is a collaboration of 10, 12 studies from Europe and the US. The time varying treatment is CART. We are going to work with a failure time outcome, AIDS or death, and we are going to have time varying confounders, which are the joint determinants of treatment and the outcome that change over time, like CD4 count. Okay, you all know that there are two types of treatment regimes, the non-dynamic and the dynamic ones, so I'm not going to dwell into this, but I want to give you some examples of what is a non-dynamic or static treatment and what is a dynamic treatment in the context of the study that we have. So if we are talking about CART, we would say, if we say, okay, I want you to start treatment at the first visit, first time I see the patient, that is a static regime. If I tell you I want you to start treatment 3 months after the first visit, that's also a static one. These are plans that don't depend on the time-dependent coverage, on the subject-specific time-varying risk factors. This is almost never used in clinical practice. But this is what most randomized clinical trials do. So most randomized clinical trials compare non-dynamic treatment plans, even though in clinical practice they are never used. And of course, this may not be optimal because for some patients it may be better to start at baseline and for some patients 3 months after base. Then I'm giving you here two examples of dynamic treatment plans that we are interested in here. Is start CART the first time that CD4 count drops below 500, or the first time that drops below 350. Now, this is what people use in clinical practice. They use this type of strategies. But there are very few trials that actually do this because I don't know why, actually. It's not harder, really, but there are few trials that do this. And of course, the optimal clinical strategy is in this class. So for example, if I tell you start CART after 3 months, then for anyone, I know exactly, take person one, I know that this person is going to start treatment in month three. So the treatment is going to be 0000 up to month three, and then it's going 1111111. And I know this for every single person in my data set. I know for every single person I'm going to include in my study, I know exactly that this is going to be 0001111111, because it's a non-dynamic plan. But I don't know that for a dynamic one. I have this person say, I want to treat the first time that EC4 count is less than 500. I don't know when that's going to happen. I need to have information on the EC4 count. And then I see that the EC4 count goes under 500 here, month six. So now I know for this person, I'm going to have 0000001. But for a different person, it will be a different series of zeros and ones. OK, this is the kind of regime that we are going to look at. If we wanted, say that we want to compare only these two plans. One is a start card, first time that C4 count drops below 500. Another one, first time that C4 count drops below 200. So we could conduct a trial in which people are assigned to one of these two strategies and then choose the one that results in the lowest mortality rate. In our case, it's a little bit more complicated because we actually have more than two. We have, say, 31 possible strategies here, which is our star card when C4 counter count first drops below X, where X can take any value from 200 to 500 in, say, steps of 10. Less than 10 really doesn't make any clinical difference. So we are trying to decide what is the optimal regime out of this class of 31. And when I say optimal here, I mean in this class and with the utility function that I'm using, which is hazard ratio. It's going to be the rate. It may be different for a different utility function. OK, if we could conduct a randomized experiment for this, we would search for HIV-infected patients that meet all the eligibility criteria to be part of this experiment, which means that they have not started CART yet, that they have a C4 count between 200 and 500, and that they have never been under 500, over 500. They have never been less than 500 before. So these people meet all the eligibility criteria for our study. We will randomly assign them to each of the 31 plans that we want to compare. We'll follow them until death or the end of the study and choose the plan of the 31 with the lowest rate, death rate. But that is not going to be feasible because we cannot have a randomized trial with enough power with 31 arms. So what we do is the next best thing that we can do, which is trying to mimic that trial using observational data. So we go to our observational data and look for patients that meet the same eligibility criteria that they need to meet to be in our hypothetical experiment. And then we look at the patient's data and determine which of the 31 regimes these people are following. And we assign them to the one that they are following. So we look at the data and see the data for this patient is consistent with starting C4 count the first time with a starting card, the first time that C4 count drops under 350, therefore this person is following that one. We classify people looking at their data, and then we can compare those groups. We do something else, is that we censor them when they deviate from the treatment. So at some point, someone may look like is going to be in the group start the first time under 350, but suddenly that person starts the first time under 420. So now we censor that person because he's not following the regime that we mean. And I'm going to explain this better. I'm just giving you the overview here. Okay, so once we have people assigned to one of these 31 regimes, we just follow them until death or the end of the study, find the regime that has the lowest that rate and choose that one. Of course, along the way, we have to adjust for confounding, because this is an observational study. It is not a randomized trial. OK, so this approach that I just sketched here has some problems. The first problem is that people don't follow one regime only. If you look at people's data, you will find that their data are consistent with following more than one. And that's a problem. So let me give you an example. This person, person one, started CART the first month of observation at baseline, at month zero. So this person started at month zero with a CFR count of 462. That means that this person is following all the regimes that say start the first time under 500, the first time under 490, the first time under 480, and the first time under 470. Because she has started the first time under all those numbers. So this person is following 4 out of the 31 possible regimes. This person, number 2, see, at time at baseline, she didn't start hard and had a CFR count of 451. That means that at baseline, this person is following the regimes, start the first time under 450, 440, 430, et cetera, all the way to 200. Month 2, her CFR count is 417, and she has not started hard. So now she's following all the regimes, start first time under 410, 400, et cetera, et cetera. So at baseline, she was following 26 of the 31 possible plans. At time 2, is following 22. At time 3, 336, that is when she starts hard. So now she's following all the regimes that say start the first time under 410, 400, 390, 380, 370, et cetera. So she's following now 8. Each person is following a different number of the data for each person is consistent with following a different number of regimes at each time. So what we do to deal with this is to make multiple copies of every person. So if a person is following 22 plans, we make 22 copies of that person. And each copy is following one of those plans. So we assign each copy, each replicate for that person to one of the regimes that the person is following. And for each one, we artificially censor that replicate when it stops following the regime that was assigned to. For example, person one is following regimes, we said, the 4 regimes for 470 to 500. So we make 4 copies of this person, copy 1, 2, 3, and 4. And each of these copies is assigned to one of the regimes that the person is following. So now this person is going to be 4 for our practical purposes, not only 1, because we cannot decide which one the person was following. For person 2, we are going to make now 26 copies here, and 22 there, and 8 there. So just to give you an example, so this is the replicates 1 to 4 here. This person is now following all the regimes between 451 and 417. We make the first replicates for all these, then we have replicates for this and replicates for that. Okay, so we are going to have a lot of copies for every person. So that solves the problem of the multiplicity of regimes that each person can follow. The second problem is that the artificial censoring in itself may introduce bias. It's a kind of informative censoring because we are censoring based on a function of treatment and a risk factor for the outcome, CD per gun. So the way that we deal with this censoring, with artificial censoring, is by inverse probability weighting. So I know that many of you know about this. IP weighting can be used to mimic a pseudo population in which treatment is exogenous in economic econometricians, or in which treatment is not confounding for epidemiologists. So what we want to do then is we are going to IP weight, create this pseudo population with no confounding, and because censoring is based on treatment, once there is no confounding for treatment, censoring becomes non-informative. And now we don't have to worry about the possibility of introducing censoring, I mean bias, by artificially censoring people with the stop following one of the regimes. And of course, I'm doing this in a very informal way, but this requires the assumption of exchangeability, positivity, and consistency, as always when we use IP weighting. The weights are the usual weights that we define for time-dependent treatments. So for each person at each time, we have a weight that is the inverse of the density of treatment evaluated at the random treatment that each person had. Okay, to estimate the weight, we use some parametric method. For example, in this case, treatment is 0-1 at each time, so we use a logistic model to estimate the conditional probability of treatment given all the past covariates, L, and past treatment, which in this case is 0 because we are only estimating the risk of initiation of treatment. So, for example, for person two, we will estimate the risk of initiating treatment given all the covariates at each time, except at time 0. We don't need to do that one because we are already adjusting for the baseline covariates in our model, and that takes care of all confounding at time 0. So we estimate at time 1, at time 2, 3, 4, before we expand the data. And then we expand the data and just copy all those estimates there. Then we need to do the weights for censoring, which happen to be the same as the weights for treatment, because what is the probability? Take person 2, month 1. The IP weight for treatment would be 1 over the probability that CRT equals 0. That is 1 over 1 minus the estimated quantity that we have from our model is this. But that's also equal to the risk of not being censored at that time. So it's exactly the same thing. We can talk about weight for treatment or weight for censoring. It's exactly the same thing for all times and all people. Okay. The third problem that we have is that, okay, now we have this expanded data set with artificial censoring, and now we just need to compare the 31 possible treatment plans and estimate the hazard of death for each of them and choose the one with the lowest hazard ratio. We could do that, for example, by fitting a Cox model. Something like this, doesn't have to be this, but something like this is a Cox model for death, when we have an indicator, it's called a G, that is 1 if the person is following regime X, and 0 if the person is following regime 500. So we do this 30 times. We fit 30 separate Cox models, one for each X, get 30 hazard ratios and choose the regime with the lowest hazard ratio. That's one way of doing it, but that's very inefficient. So rather than doing that, which would be a very inefficient thing, and to give you an idea of how inefficient this is, in our data, we have 60,000 people with HIV after and 2,000 deaths. After applying the eligibility criteria for this particular randomized trial that we are trying to mimic, we end up with 9,000 only. But after doing all the artificial censoring, we end up with 122 deaths. So if we now try to estimate 30 hazard ratios in the way that I describe, is not a good way of doing it. So what do we do? Well, we do the usual thing. We feed a model, and we make assumptions. So we, rather than fitting these 30 separate Cox models that I said, rather than that, we fit one model, one Cox model of this form, in which we add the variable X we model the hazard as a function, as a continuous function of the variable X that goes from 200 to 500, or we take the difference of X. So say that we could assume that the association follows a cubic polynomial or any other smooth function that is flexible enough to allow for different shapes of the hazard. We fit this small, and then we can compute the hazard ratio for each regime and the minimum hazard ratio for each of them. Now, this kind of model, this weighted Cox model, estimates the parameters of a dynamic marginal structural model, which is something like this. So what we are doing by assuming some functional form for the variable X, representing which is an index for clinical strategy, we are modeling the hazard under each of the regimes of interest using that, and under the usual assumptions of exchangeability, positivity, and consistency, our weighted Cox model is estimating a marginal structural Cox model. In this case, we say it's a dynamic marginal structural Cox model because we are comparing dynamic treatment plans. The history of dynamic MSNs very quickly. We did a very simple one in 2006, and then the more general form was developed by Robbins and others, and by van der Laan and others almost at the same time. And in a chapter of a book, Jamie and I have a summary of all of this kind of models for those of you who want to read that. Okay, there are other issues here. Of course, this is only as good as the data that we have. If there is unmeasured confounding, we will have unmeasured confounding. The choice of the utility function is not a trivial problem. I chose the hazard ratio, but there are many other options. There are issues with the frequency of measurement, because of course the optimal regime depends on how frequent CIFAR counts are obtained. If they are obtained every month, it's different than if they are obtained every 2 years only, because you may want to start much earlier if you know that the next one is going to happen in 2 years rather than in 1 month. And this is exactly what Jamie is going to be talking about later. Some estimate from our data after using this method, and as far as we know, this is the first time that the method has been used. This shows the hazard ratios in comparison for each of the 30 regimes under 500 in versus the 501, and you see that the hazard ratios tend to go up. So what we're finding is that starting at 500 is the best thing that you can do. So don't wait, start at 500. How much time do I have?
1 or 2 minutes.
1 or 2 minutes. Okay, so just a quick comment then, that we have mimicked some type of trial here, but that may not be the best possible trial or the most interesting one from a clinical point of view. So we could have tried to mimic other trials. For example, this is what we did. The first time that someone got after 500, we randomized them, we mimicked that, to starting at either a 500 or 490 or 480 or 470, etc. But something that may be more interesting from a clinical point of view is, well, first time that we observe someone above 500, now we intervene in that we now say, if you are above 500, you cannot start treatment until you are below 500. So for all the time between being above 500, first time that we see it, until you get below 500, for all that time, we have a fixed intervention common to everybody in our study, which is you cannot start. First time that you go under 500, now we randomized one of the 31 plans that we said before. This may be more interesting from a clinical point of view because you are observing people, they are over 500, and now you decide whether you start at 500. Whereas here, you are starting right the first time they're under 500, it may not be as informative. So this type of trial could be B. A is the one that I show you, this would be B. And here we expand the data from stage 2, like we did for A. But now we have to estimate weights for both stage 1, the weights of not starting treatment, and for stage 2, the same way that I described here. But then when we fit our weighted structural Cox model, the start of follow-up is here. Because, of course, what happens here doesn't matter because everybody is assigned to the same regime up to here. So all the deaths that happen before that don't count. And then we can do, and this is what we get when we do that. And then we can do another type of trial, C, which is that at this time, we assign every person to one of the 31 plans. So rather than saying, so we say, you are not going to take any treatment here, and then you are going to start, say, at 490. But we assign that not here, but there, which means that now the start of follow-up from our model is here, and all the deaths that happen in between now count, because we know, at this time, we know what is the regime that this person is following. If we do that, now we have to expand all data for all the possible regimes. We have to estimate weights for both stage 1 and stage 2, and then, as I said, we fit the weighted model from the beginning of stage 1, and if we do that, results are very attenuated, because now, of course, all the deaths during stage 1 count, and those are common to all the regimes. So we are answering very different clinical questions by trying to mimic different trials with very different designs, and we get different answers, as expected. Okay, so my final comment is that for this type of problems, it's very unlikely that we are going to have one trial, one randomized experiment that is going to answer the question. And observational studies are our best chance to try to find the optimal one, or at least to guide the design of trials, because observational studies can kind of bound where the action is. So now you can design trials based on those results for final confirmation. And that's some references there. Thank you.
Maybe while we're
switching over, we have time for one question. And I'll introduce the next speaker, who is Elia Ares, at the same time.
What is BCPNG?
It's a very obscure journal. Basic and clinical pharmacology and toxicology. Yes?
Thanks for your presentation. I was just wondering, so in light of the results, it seemed that 500 was the optimal, but you weren't considering anything above 500. You think now, if you were to do it over, you'd say, well, we have to go a bit farther. And
right. Yeah.
Above 500?
We don't have enough data for that, because once we try to go above 500, of course, now we have as an eligibility criterion, these people have to be above 500 at the start. And there are very few people that are observed in these studies above 500. So we end up with very few people. But yes, that is the next step.
Interesting things you might wish to consider, like other time since seroconversion or previous. Mm-hmm.
Right. It is a question of how you define the class of treatment plans that you are interested in, and this method can be applied to any of those.
I just gave you an example. Issue as well.